Discerning Hearts provides content dedicated to those on the spiritual journey. To continue production of these podcasts, prayers, and more, go to discerninghearts.com and click the donate link found there or inside the free Discerning Hearts app to make your donation. Thanks, and God bless.
DiscerningHearts.com presents St. Thérèse and Marie, the story of two cousins with Father Timothy Gallagher. Father Gallagher is a member of the Oblates of the Virgin Mary, a religious community dedicated to retreats and spiritual formation, according to the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola. Father Gallagher is featured on several series on the EWTN television network, including Living the Discerning Life. He's the author of numerous books on the teachings of St. Ignatius of Loyola, as well as on the teachings of Venerable Bruno Lanteri, founder of the Oblates of the Virgin Mary. St. Thérèse and Marie, the story of two cousins with Father Timothy Gallagher. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Welcome back, Father Gallagher.
Thanks, Chris.
In our previous conversation, you had given us such a wonderful vantage point of observing that moment with the Pope and the correspondence between Thérèse and Marie. I think it's really remarkable that we're having this opportunity to see Thérèse with yet another light cast upon this beautiful story of hers.
Yeah, I don't think you ever finish. I know I've said in one of our earlier conversations that I began, well, Thérèse was a part of my story from early on, even before seminary. But some years ago, I returned to her and thought, I'll just read everything and really get a complete understanding of Thérèse. But you never do, because ultimately, it's the mystery of God's relationships with the human person, and there's an infinite love there. There's the divine at work. But in Thérèse, there is always more to learn. I don't know if I said this before, but I was talking with my spiritual director once about and saying that I'd really like to put up a photograph of Thérèse, you know, frame it and have it on the wall in my office, but there's no room. He said, there's always room for Thérèse. And of course, I have one on the wall now. That's one way of describing this, that if we ever think that we have thoroughly grasped Thérèse, that probably means that there's more to learn. It certainly means that there's more to learn. And that's a wonderful thing. It's like that lovely passage from St. Ephrem the Deacon, when he talks about the traveler who has a great thirst and comes across a fountain along the way, bends down and satisfies his thirst, but the water keeps pouring out, and he's not upset that he can't absorb all the water. It's to his good that he can't, because the next time he's thirsty, it'll still be there to feed him even more. And I think Thérèse is kind of like that. We may at one point feel that we've understood her fully, but you go back to her a little bit later and look a little more deeply, and you realize with a real sense of joy and delight, wow, there's more and more and more here. And I think with Thérèse, a number of the authors, von Balthasar and others, have commented on this, how, call it the rhetoric or the language that she uses, which is the language of the time, can hide sometimes the steel, the diamond, the profundity of what's being said. But you get familiar enough with Thérèse to begin to see past that, and then, well, you just can't get enough, you know?
What I think what you are doing now, Father Gallagher, is giving us that sense of Thérèse where she's, at least for me, and if I can communicate a lot of the responses that we're getting from people who are hearing this, the relatability of Thérèse because of the engagement and interaction with her family members. The family dynamic and the extended family makes her even more relatable, because we see the interaction of not of her, only just her telling the story, but how they view her and their experience of her, and even how they may influence her. That whole dynamic, it's so organic, and it makes her even more than just the saint we've seen on holy cards or have lit a candle at a church.
Sure, and that's all the more true of Thérèse, because until she enters the Carmel, her her only relationships are with family. She just doesn't have relationships outside of family. Part of that is that their home, Les Buissonnets, was a bit isolated, but most of it was due to Thérèse's own emotional struggles, you know, during those years, so that she was only comfortable within the family. So if you notice, I mean, all these letters we're looking at, they're all with members of her immediate family or her cousins. Then when she enters the Carmel, she's one of, it shifted a little bit, but let's say on average about 25, 26 sisters during the years that she's there. So again, it's a very limited pool of people. The only way to see Thérèse as she lives the second great commandment, you know, to love others, is to see it in the family and then later in the Carmel. Now, even when she joins the Carmel, her relationships with her family remain very central and very important. They come and they visit in the Carmel, or the extended correspondence, and how she lives, the joys and the sufferings of the family. For example, her father's, his illness and death and all that's involved. So to separate Thérèse from her family, probably more than almost any other saint, is no longer to have eyes to see her, at least as she relates to other people and lives the love of the Lord in relationship with others. So yeah, that's absolutely critical for understanding Thérèse. And we're very blessed, as the centenary of her birth was approaching, so she's born in 1873, and as 1973 was approaching, a wonderful team of priests and nuns, there may have been some lay people as well, it's a fairly restricted team, conceived the project of a critical edition of all of Thérèse's writings, and they accomplished that over the course of 25 years in 8 volumes. And the translations that we use in English are all translations from that just amazing piece of scholarship, the notes that are there and the correlation of texts and so forth. So we have access to that in a way that would not have been true before the centenary, before 1973. And then also we have on the archive of the Carmel of Lisieux, which is in both languages. You have it in French in the originals, and then in English translation, vast amounts of this correspondence are available. When we get past the death of Thérèse, the only access that we have, the general public has, to Marie's continuing correspondence is through that website where you can find them. So I have been using, and we will use, those resources as we go forward. But yeah, I think I mentioned earlier, Father Stéphane Joseph Piat, P-I-A-T, who I would say is probably the second great commentator on Thérèse, the first being Bishop Guy Gaucher. When he wrote his, call it A Life of Thérèse, he called it The Story of a Family. And that's a perfect title for it. And you do see the family members, Thérèse's parents, her sisters, her cousins, and so forth, interacting with her. That's absolutely fundamental. Yeah, it's the only way to really get to know Thérèse. The next letter that we're going to take is a letter from May 29th, 1889. And this is a letter that Marie writes to Thérèse. And then we're going to read her response. Whenever Marie Guérin is mentioned in the telling the story of Thérèse, almost invariably this letter is quoted and Thérèse's response. And in fact, there was a further echo to this, because when the cause of Thérèse's beatification was begun in 1910, well, I'll tell the story in its own time, but this letter, her response, was shown to St. Pius X, the Pope. And when he read it, he just said, this cause has to go forward. But we'll detail that a little better down the line. But just to say that if you do find Marie Guérin mentioned in telling the story of Thérèse, almost always this letter will be quoted. And it's also helpful for us because it gives us a deep insight into one of the great sufferings that Marie had and that she brings to Thérèse, and that is her scrupulosity. Now, the background to this is, so it's, as I said, it's a year and a half after that trip to Rome. In the meantime, Thérèse has entered the Carmel. At this point, she's been in the Carmel a little bit over a year, and she's a novice. And the immediate background to the letter is that in 1889, on the centenary of the French Revolution, so you have the storming of the Bastille in July 14th, 1789, which is considered the the beginning of the French Revolution. And on the occasion of the centenary, France decides to have a major, kind of a world's fair in Paris to celebrate this. And this is known by as the Exposition, the Paris Exposition of 1889. And this starts in May of 1889, and it will go through October. So it's for 6 months, this will be running in Paris. And this is the time when the Eiffel Tower is built, for example, as part of this celebration. And it's a huge event for these 6 months. Over 32 million people came to Paris for this. They had over 62,000 exhibits from either France or the colonies. There were various sites in Paris where the various buildings of the exposition were held. They built what they called the Palace of Machines, and so the latest machinery that had been invented. And you can see pictures of it. It's huge and just great numbers of what was the latest technology at the time. You also had a palace for the arts, for painting and the liberal arts. There were two different buildings. And a lot of the famous painters of the time, think of Cézanne and Renoir and so forth. You have all of this cultural effervescence in France at this time with great painters and great writers. And this is a celebration of some of that as well. Another part of this as a draw for the visitors was the composing and then the putting on of operas and concerts and dances, exposition of paintings and so forth. So you have this, for 6 months, Paris is packed with visitors from great distances, and you have this major exposition. I remember I was young at the time going to the World's Fair in 1964 in New York City, and I can still remember a little bit of the air of this. Great crowds of people, so many things to look at, kind of exciting and energy in the air. Now, this starts at the beginning of May, and we're now on May 23rd. Isidore takes the family, so that's his wife, Celine, and his two girls, Jeanne and Marie, and with the other two Martin sisters who are still at home, and that's Léonie and Celine. He takes them to Paris to visit this exposition, and they stay there for 8 days. So they're there from May 23rd to May 31st. And we're now at May 29th, so the family has been there for 6 days, immersed in all of this. And 2 days before they leave, Marie, just desperate and struggling, writes to Thérèse the following letter. "My dear Thérèse, I am coming again to bother you." Now, the "again" tells us that very likely the scruples and struggles that she's going to share, this is not the first time that she has either written to Thérèse or spoken in the parlor at the Carmel with Thérèse about these things. So Thérèse will be well aware of this kind of struggle in Marie. "I am coming again to bother you, and I know in advance that you are not going to be pleased with me." Just Thérèse hates to see her bringing so much suffering on herself in this way. "But what do you expect? I am suffering so much that it does me good to pour all my pains into your heart. Paris was not made for healing the scrupulous. I no longer know where to turn my eyes. If I flee from one nudity, I meet another, and so it goes on all day long." Well, she doesn't get into any more details. It's all written very nicely, but there she tells you exactly what's bothering her. "And so it goes on all day long." Now, you can just image this. You can just image this 19-year-old girl who's grown up in a small city in a very Catholic area, you know, of Normandy, and suddenly in Paris, and with all of this celebration and arts and dances and paintings and all the different styles and so forth that she's experiencing, and she's just overwhelmed by all of this. "It's enough to make you die of sorrow. It seems to me that I do this out of curiosity," and this is where the scruple is. It's almost as she's experiencing, "It doesn't matter where I look, I'm going to see something that I shouldn't see. And then it seems to me that I really want to see these things." So you can see the torment of the scruples here. "I have to be looking everywhere." So that's, she's blaming herself. It seems to me that it is to see evil. In other words, I want to see these things. That's what I'm afraid of. I don't know if you will understand me, but Thérèse will understand her, because there's a phase earlier where Thérèse herself went through severe scruples for about a year and a half. She'll remind Marie of that. I don't know if you will understand me, but I have so much in my poor head that I don't know how to sort it out. Neither does the demon fail to bring to my mind all these evil things that I saw during the day, and this is another subject of torment. So she sees these things, but the images are now there, and when she's elsewhere, the images are still there. And then here's her question to Thérèse. How do you expect me to receive Holy Communion tomorrow and Friday? So tomorrow is the Feast of the Ascension, Thursday, and then Friday is May 31st, the end of the month of Mary, and she has planned to go to Communion on both days. Now, how's Thérèse going to respond to this? How do you expect me to receive Holy Communion tomorrow and Friday? I am obliged to abstain from it. This is the great trial, for never have I felt so much love for Holy Communion. And this is deep in Marie, that we've already touched on it a little, and we'll see it consistently. A great love for the Eucharist. A great love for the Eucharist. And I can't go. I can't receive, because I've been complicit in seeing things that are not good for me. It's my fault. And this is the great trial, for never have I felt so much love for Holy Communion. I feel that I would be flooded with consolations, that is, if I could receive communion. I would feel fortified if I could have God in my heart. Otherwise, my poor heart is so empty. It is filled with sadness, and nothing can distract me. Oh, what a city Paris is! One is much happier in the little house on the Rue Condorcet, which is the home of the Guérin family at this point in Lisieux. Do you know where I feel the most joy? It is when I am in church. At least there I can rest my eyes on the tabernacle. I feel at home, and all the rest is not made for me. Now just pause for a moment just to note what's being said here. Probably some of that intense desire in some sense, that is to be in church before the Blessed Sacrament, is for relief from seeing things that she doesn't want to see. But at the heart of it is something very deep and very beautiful in Marie. She just loves the Eucharist. She just loves that's where I'm home, more than anywhere else. Do you know where I feel the most joy? It is when I am in church, and all the rest is not made for me. I don't know how one can live here. As far as I am concerned, this is a veritable hell. I am sorry, dear Thérèse, for not having written you earlier. At least you would have been able to answer me. And this would have done me so much good to be consoled a little. You can also see that the relationship has really shifted at this point. These are not two young girls talking about experiences on vacation by the sea, but this is a young woman suffering from very painful scrupulosity and seeking for light and guidance from Thérèse. And the relationship is very clear. They're still cousins and great friends and all the rest, but now what comes very much to the fore is Marie's sense that Thérèse understands her and can respond to her spiritual sufferings. However, I would really like to receive a little note of consolation when I return to Lisieux. So they're going to be there 2 more days, and she'd love to find a letter waiting for her when she gets home. In point of fact, it's a very beautiful thing. Thérèse writes to her the next day, and so she gets this letter even before she leaves Paris. And let's keep in mind that for Thérèse to write letters, it was not a simple thing of finding a nice quiet place, sitting down at a desk and writing calmly. She had no time to write until finally they had a free hour from 8 to 9 in the evening. So with the tiredness and everything of the day, she would use that time to write as quickly as she could, because she often had more than one letter to write. And she had no way of studying her prose or anything. She just had to write quickly from her heart.
You know what's amazing, Father Gallagher, is the fact that several things. But first, that Marie was able to get it out. She had somebody that she could talk to. She actually described it and was able to get it out. what she was experiencing in Paris, I don't doubt that so many young people now, and adults, I mean, even to my age, when they go on the internet, they don't have to travel to a different city. You watch television or whatever that might be. But she was able to express it, trust enough, and then send that to Therese. And then the miracle of it all is that letter is still with us. That type of correspondence that speaks even today, it's kind of jaw-dropping when you really sit and ponder this.
Well, one of the great demonstrations of love, and it's not all that common. It is there, thankfully, but it's not all that common, is the love that consists in really listening to another person. In fact, so much so that you have a lovely essay by Simone Weil, W-E-I-L, in which she says that attention is the real heart of love. You put yourself aside and you open your eyes and your ears to another person and you simply receive that person in all of that person's joy and sorrow and richness and struggle. She calls that a miracle. And Therese has this in a remarkable degree. Yeah, we just quoted Marie, who says, I'm writing this to you. I know it's you won't want to hear about these struggles, but I know you understand me. And if there's anything you can say about Therese, her love was an understanding love. You'll see it with her different sisters in the Carmel. She knows just how to approach each one. She's so sensitive to the different personalities and strengths and struggles, and she knows how to speak with great love to that. So yes, that does highlight a quality of Therese. People knew they could speak with her, and they knew they'd be understood, and they'd be encouraged. And that encouragement runs through letters that we'll see here, but it runs through every letter Therese ever wrote. It's always there, whether it's the seminarian Maurice who's struggling, or here Marie, burdened by scruples, and you could go on through the list of them. Yeah, it's a beautiful kind of love, really just attention, as Simone Weil calls it, and Therese has it here. And Marie, because she knows that Therese has that understanding, knows that she can share what is not easy to share. She knows that she can share this with Therese, and she'll be understood and helped. So she says, however, I would really like to receive a little note of consolation when I return to Lisieux. If this is not asking too much, and if you can't answer me at Paris, to do this you would have to write me tomorrow, Thursday, which is what Therese does, in order for me to receive the letter on Friday morning. On Friday night I shall be in the city of my birth, and it is the best of all. I look upon Paris with horror. Pray for your little sister Marie, who loves you with her whole heart. Pay my respects, I beg you, to Mother Marie de Gonzague and Mother Genevieve, and recommend me to their good prayers. Kiss Marie and Pauline for me. Now that's Marie's letter. How's Therese going to respond to this? Again, this is 16-year-old Therese, but you just have to put aside chronology in terms of years of life for Therese, because her spiritual journey goes at such a deep rate. So Therese replies immediately the next day. We can see Therese, let's say it's 8 p.m., she's alone in her cell. And to write, they had a little wooden piece that they could put over their knees as they half knelt on the floor. And that's, you'd see her with the little oil lamp that she has and her ink and paper. My dear little sister, you did well to write to me. So that's the first thing. I'm so happy that you wrote. You were afraid that I would be displeased with you. No, I'm so glad that you wrote. You did well to write to me, and I understand, look what she says here, four times, and she underlines it each time, and I understand everything, 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 exclamation point. So that's the first thing. She just wants Marie to know, and what I'm going to say, don't remotely think that I don't understand. And because I don't understand, I want to say you're not guilty, etc. I want you to know as strongly as you can say it in a sentence, repeated four times and underlined an exclamation point, I really understand. And in part, it'll be because Therese herself went through such difficulties with scruples earlier. that all changed with that grace of Christmas, if you, we remember. And then she says, you haven't committed the shadow of any evil. And this is underlined, shadow of any evil. You haven't committed the shadow of any evil. Now, let's just picture Marie in her hotel in Paris reading this letter. I know what these kinds of temptations are so well that I can assure you of this without any fear. And besides, so she brings out kind of pretty strong weapons here. And besides, so I know because I know this kind of temptation, and I know you, and I know that you have not fallen into this kind of sinfulness, we'll say. So I know because I'm familiar with this. And then besides, Jesus tells me this in the depth of my heart. All right, this is no longer the young girl, you know, just sharing times of play and so forth with a much-loved cousin and friend. And besides, Jesus tells me this in the depth of my heart. And then this is how we respond. We must despise all these temptations and pay no attention whatsoever to them. I can hear Ignatius in this, you know. We must despise all these temptations. Don't even give them place in your thoughts. Don't even wonder whether there might be something in them. Simply scorn them, despise them, reject them, and pay no attention at all to them. And she can write very confidently because she knows Marie. She knows her so deeply. Shall I tell you something that has given me much sorrow? And she underlines the word much. How do you suppose what she's going to say next here? Should I tell you something that has given me much sorrow? Therese doesn't often speak about a sorrow like this. Should I tell you something that has given me much sorrow? It is that my little Marie has given up her communions. Oh, you didn't go to communion. Oh, it makes me so sad that you didn't go. It is that my little Marie has given up her communions on the Feast of the Ascension, so that was the day she wrote, the day before, and on the last day of Mary's month. Oh, what sorrow this has caused Jesus. So the sorrow here is not that you have sinned and that you've deliberately exposed yourself to impurity and temptations and played with these things in your mind. The sorrow here is that you believed enough of the enemy's discouraging lies that you didn't receive Jesus in communion. That's the real sorrow here. The devil has to be very clever to mislead a soul in this way. But don't you know, my dear, that this is the only goal of his desires? The evil one knows well that he can't make a soul that wants to belong totally to Jesus. Now that's certainly Marie. That he can't make a soul that wants to belong totally to Jesus commit a sin. So he tries to make the soul believe that it has. So we're at the heart of scruples here. It is already much for him to put disturbance in this soul, but to satisfy his rage, something else is needed. He wants to deprive Jesus of a loved tabernacle, which isn't a beautiful thing. So what she's saying, Marie approaches the church because in the tabernacle, Jesus is there. And Therese says, what Jesus so deeply wants is that you be his tabernacle, that he be received into your person, into your soul, into your heart. He wants to deprive Jesus of a loved tabernacle, and not being able to enter this sanctuary, he wants at least that it remain empty and without any master. So the devil, of course, and this is classic theology, has no direct access to the deep center of our hearts, our minds, and our wills. Only God does. But if he can't, but since he can't enter there, he can at least discourage the soul from having Jesus come in there through receiving communion. Alas, what will become of this poor heart? When the devil has succeeded in drawing the soul away from Holy Communion, he has won everything, and she underlines that, has won everything. And Jesus weeps. O my darling, think then that Jesus is there in the tabernacle. I almost wish that everybody listening, let Therese say these words to you. And I'll kind of let her say them to me as well. Think then that Jesus is there in the tabernacle expressly for you. You is underlined. For you alone. You alone is underlined. He is burning with the desire to enter your heart. I don't know if we ever think of Jesus that way. Just longing to enter into our hearts, that we be his tabernacle. And that he, if he's there in the tabernacle, it's just for you in the singular and you alone. So don't listen to the devil. Mock him. Just scorn these temptations of the devil. And go without any fear to receive Jesus in peace and love. Now, she can hear Marie saying, all of that's beautiful, but I don't know if that's me. So Therese expresses her question and answers it. However, I hear you saying to me, Therese is saying all this because she doesn't know. She doesn't know I really do it on purpose. It pleases me. And so I cannot receive communion, since I believe I would commit a sacrilege. And so I cannot receive communion since I believe I would commit a sacrilege, etc., etc. Okay, I can hear you saying that to me. Yes, your poor little Therese does know. I tell you that she understands it all, and she underlines all. And she assures you that you can go without any fear to receive your only true friend. Therese at 16. And there's such spiritual poise and depth and clarity. She too, that is Therese, she too has passed through the martyrdom of scruples, and that's that year and a half that I mentioned. But Jesus has given her the grace to receive communion just the same, so she didn't stop receiving communion, even when she was tormented with scruples like this. But Jesus has given her the grace to receive communion just the same, even when she believed that she had committed great sins, and she underlines great sins. And so I assure you that she knew this was the sole means of ridding herself of the devil. For when he sees that he is losing his time, he leaves you in peace. So she's saying to Marie, I absolutely understand because I went through a year and a half of being tormented by scruples. And I learned that communion is the only way out. That's strong language, that this was the sole means of ridding herself of the devil. Because when you don't give in to the discouragement and the lies of the devil and pull away from communion, but you keep going. Then she says the devil sees that he's wasting his time, he loses heart, he leaves you in peace. No, it is impossible, and impossible, that word in capital letters. No, it is impossible that a heart, and now she quotes from Marie's letter, it is impossible that a heart, quote, which rests only at the sight of the tabernacle, end quote, offend Jesus to the point of not being able to receive him. And that's where she sees so deeply the goodness in Marie that is deeper than any of this torment of scruples. Remember I said earlier, Marie has this very intense emotional life, which is a great blessing in some ways, but can also lead to this kind of torment as well, where she just deeply gets into this almost despair. And so Therese, who knows her so deeply and knows the goodness in her, he says, look, anybody who can say that the only place I rest is before the Blessed Sacrament has not offended God to the point of not receiving communion. And then she says, not only that's not the offense, you're not guilty of that offense. What offends him and what wounds his heart is the lack of confidence, that you don't believe that I receive you with such love and such goodness, and so am burning that you be with desire that you be my tabernacle, and that you don't need to be afraid. If there's anything that offends him, it's that you don't know that. Little sister, before I received your letter, I had a presentiment of your anxiety. My heart was united to your heart. Last night in my dreams, I tried to console you, but alas, I was unable to succeed. I am not going to be any more fortunate today unless Jesus and the Blessed Virgin come to my help. I hope that my desire will be fulfilled and that on the last day of her month, so there's still time before May 31st, and that on the last day of her month, the Blessed Virgin will heal my dear little sister. But for this you must pray, pray very much, that's underlined. If you could only place a candle at Notre Dame de Victoire, and there's a lot of family history in this, Our Lady of Victories, the Church of Our Lady of Victories in Paris. Louis, when he was studying watchmaking and jewelry, he spent 3 years in Paris, and this church became a favorite place where he would go to pray and light candles for various intentions. And then later, when he sold his business to help his wife with the lace-making business, and he'd be on trips to Paris to contact buyers and vendors and so forth, he would stop. He loved to stop in this church, Notre Dame. In fact, in her last year, when Zélie was battling with the cancer, she wrote to the priest at this church to ask for his prayers. We also have a kind of, I don't know, kind of charming thing in a way. When Isidore, as a young man, is in Paris studying medicine and later pharmacy, and his attachment to the church has weakened, Zélie writes to him, and she tries to get him to be willing to stop once a day in Notre Dame de Victoire to say one Hail Mary, and she urges him to do that. And then Thérèse, on that pilgrimage down to Rome, when they started by going to Paris, she was able to go to this church, and she just loved it. It remains a very dear place in her heart, and a place where she has the sense that that Mary is present and will hear prayer. So she says, "If only you could place a candle at Notre Dame de Victoire. I have so much confidence in her." She continues, "Your heart is made to love Jesus, to love him passionately. Pray so that," and she underlines this, "the beautiful years of your life may not pass by in chimerical fears. We have only the short moments of our life to love Jesus, and the devil knows this well, so he tries to consume our life in useless works." And then she speaks with great energy as she moves toward the end of this letter. "Dear little sister, receive communion often," and she underlines those three words, "receive communion often, very often." I'll pause here to mention Pope St. Pius X. So he, as we know, he's the pope who urged frequent communion. Before his time, most Catholics would receive once a year. That was the Easter duty. You'd go to confession and receive communion. You might have a few who would receive every so many weeks. Priests were the only ones, because they celebrated Mass daily, who went to communion daily. And then Pope St. Pius X becomes pope, and he urges frequent communion. And then you have that whole shift from communion being a reward to being a food, a nourishment that we need. And then you also have the letter that is promulgated by the Vatican, and when he's pope, lowering the age of the reception of First Communion from 12 to 7. And we won't get into all the theology of that, but, you know, "let the little ones come to me." This is very dear to the heart of St. Pius X. Now, that letter was written on August 8th of the year 1910. So it's just a few months later, 10 weeks later. This is the year 1810, when Thérèse's cause of beatification is beginning and is now underway. And the priest who was the vice postulator of that cause came across this letter of Thérèse that we're just reading just now. "Dear little sister, receive communion often, very often. This is the only remedy," and so forth. And in an audience with Pius X, he shows him this letter, and Pius X reads it. And he exclaims, when he finishes reading it, he says, the editors here give his, in the original Latin, "est opportunissimum, est magnum gaudium pro me." This is so opportune. This is such a great joy for me. And then he ends his conversation with the vice postulator by saying, "we have to make this cause go forward. You know, we have to hurry this cause forward." Anyway, it's just interesting resonance of this letter. What Pius X realizes is that 20 years before his decree, Thérèse had already seen all of this so clearly and says it. "Dear little sister, receive communion often, very often. This is the only remedy," underlined only remedy, "if you want to be healed. So far from your problem being that you can't receive communion, the only real problem is that you feel that you can't. You believe the lies of the enemy, and you feel that you can't. This is the remedy. Communion is the only remedy. And Jesus hasn't placed this attraction in your soul for nothing." And that's a deep comment on Marie. "I believe that he would be pleased." This is the nice thing. "You missed two communions because you were afraid." Okay, make them up. "I believe that he would be pleased," that is Jesus, "if you could receive the two communions you missed, for then the devil's victory would be less great, since he would not have succeeded in separating Jesus from your heart. Have no fear of loving the Blessed Virgin too much. You will never," underlined, "love her enough, and Jesus will be pleased, since the Blessed Virgin is his mother." Nothing is said in Marie's letter, but you wonder if that was another worry somewhere in her heart. "Adieu, little sister. Pardon my scribbling, which I can't even read over since I don't have the time. Kiss all my dear ones for me, Therese of the Child Jesus.
You've been listening to St. Therese and Marie, the story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher. Be sure to check out the comprehensive summary and reflection questions contained in the show notes for this episode. To download this particular episode, along with hundreds of other spiritual formation programs, visit discerninghearts.com, or you can find them within the free Discerning Hearts app or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission, which is to offer authentic and rock-solid spiritual formation freely to souls around the world. And if you feel us worthy, please consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax-deductible, to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for St. Therese and Marie, the story of two cousins, with Father Timothy Gallagher.